Case number 08-1259, Joseph Stillwell, et al., Petitioners v. Office of Thrift Supervision. Mr. Smith for the petitioners, Mr. Starbenz for the respondent.
Good morning, Your Honor. Paul Smith for the petitioners, and may it please the court. Our submission in this case is that the new OTS rule authorizing a drastic limit on the percentage of shares that a minority shareholder can own in an MHC subsidiary thrift is arbitrary and capricious because it is an irrational response to the perceived problem of undue influence being exercised by minority shareholders over management. The mutual holding company structure by its very nature largely insulates management from any influence by shareholders because the managers themselves, of course, always control and vote a majority of the stock of the institution. Just about the only situation in which minority shareholders have any role to play in influencing management is when they're asked to vote up or down on a management proposal for management's own stock benefit plans, stock grants, or stock options. And that exception exists because, of course, the managers have a huge conflict of interest when they're deciding their own compensation, deciding how much stock to give themselves. And the OTS itself reconsidered the question and said just 2 years ago that this safeguard is very important. They're going to leave it in place. It is the primary check on the excessively lucrative stock benefit plans established by managers for themselves. Now, despite the fact that managers are largely insulated from the influence of shareholders, the OTS rule was based on this perception that shareholders are causing problems for management and causing harm to thrifts because their minority shareholders are saying to management, unless you take this harmful action, harmful to the interests of the bank, an action you wouldn't otherwise take, we will not approve your stock benefit plan and you won't have your stock benefit plan. And that, I think, that once you sort of understand that scenario, that's where the illogic of the OTS rule and the problem we have here really crystallizes because...
Excuse me, you're saying that that it's in a situation where the management is being asked to do something inimical to the interests of the bank?
Right, something they wouldn't otherwise do as managers in their exercise of their fiduciary duties, something
that... I thought the objection was not that what they were doing was inimical, necessarily inimical to the interests of the bank, but rather diverted the bank's proceeds from the stock issuance away from the regulator's mission of having them lend it for mortgages and so on.
No, Your Honor, the only rationale that's supplied here is that the ability to vote up or down on the management stock benefit plan allows the minority shareholders to force management to do things that are benefit to of the minority shareholders, like buying back stock or moving toward a conversion toward a full a publicly owned institution. And that those are things, presumably the reason that's a bad thing is because management doesn't think that's in the long-term interests of the thrift. And so what the essence of their argument is that the problem we have here is that managers are too prone to put their own self-interest in getting stock benefits ahead of the interests of the bank, and therefore they're caught in a bind here, and we're afraid that they're going to do things that are not in the long-term interest of the thrift at the behest of the minority shareholders in order to get their stock benefits through. That's the basic gist of what the OTS said. And so the real problem with that is if you have that perception about bank management that they're going to put their self-interest ahead of the interests of the bank, then it would seem like the last thing you would want to do is water down and relax the safeguards that protect against managers giving themselves excessively lucrative stock benefits. And what is the safeguard for that? It is the minority stockholder election, the process of requiring the minority shareholders to approve the stock benefits, just as stockholders approve stock benefits all throughout corporate America. There's nothing particularly unusual about this. The only difference in this context is it's just the minority shareholders who vote, because, of course, if management voted, they would approve all of them. They have a majority control. So essentially what OTS has done here is solve one, at least hypothetical, problem of this undue influence by so watering down the ability of minority shareholders to effectively oppose the stock benefit plans that they the underlying problem of the conflict of interest of management is no longer really being addressed.
I'm not sure why you disagreed with me earlier. This is from the summary of argument of the government's brief. The agency's consistent focus has been to ensure that the process is equitable, that all interested parties are treated fairly but are not able to achieve a windfall, and most importantly, that the stock proceeds, that's from the issuance, are not siphoned off by insiders or investors, but rather preserved to strengthen the issuer's capital position so the bank can better serve the credit needs of its community, including home financing. That's exactly what I put to you.
Well, perhaps I didn't understand it, Your Honor. Clearly, there is this injection of capital that occurs when they issue a minority stock. And then the question is, what will then happen in that new world where this stock issues? Will either the managers end up getting excessive compensation out of it, or will somehow the minority shareholders do something untoward?
Well, I think can we agree that the interests of the minority shareholders and the interests of the interests of all the minority shareholders are congruent? Right. So if the activist organizes or is able to exert influence with less than all of the votes in proxy, there's no problem there because all of the shareholders want to see the bank maximize its value.
But, and maximize the return to shareholders.
Yes, maximize the value for shareholders. Yes. Right? There's no conflict there.
I'm with you so far.
The conflict is between maximizing the value to shareholders and pursuing this other goal that the agency deems to be in the public interest, which is not maximizing the benefit to shareholders, but pursuing mortgage lending.
Well, and
which in recent times has been quite bad for shareholders.
But, Your Honor, that in order for that problem to arise, you have to assume that management is going to acquiesce to some demand from the minority shareholders, which they otherwise wouldn't do, and they'll do it because they put their own interests ahead of the interests of the bank in continuing to have those proceeds available for lending.
Well, it's a temptation.
Well, yes, Your Honor, but what do you do if that's how you perceive the problem? You have two choices. You can either regulate what the managers do in response to that temptation, or you can water down the ability of minority shareholders to actually put them in that dilemma. But if you do that, which is what they've done, to the point where the vote by the minority shareholders becomes a formality, then you have this other problem, which is that the management can vote themselves these lucrative stock benefits, and there's no effective review process. Even though OTS said just 2 years ago, this is a really important review process. We're going to keep it in place because it is the primary check on the greed of managers in voting themselves excessive stock benefit plans. It's like squeezing a balloon. If you try to solve one problem, you make the other one worse. If you're trying to solve both problems by tinkering with the ability of minority shareholders to disapprove of management stock benefit plans, the more rational response is to say, we'll let the minority shareholders continue to operate as an effective check on management voting themselves these benefits, and then to the extent that occasionally leads minority shareholders to push management to do something undesirable, we have all these regulatory systems in place. They can't buy back stock without approval for a year. They can't sell themselves without approval. They can't move toward a conversion toward a full stock institution without approval. OTS has an enormous amount of other regulatory.
But they can adopt a stock option plan without,
yes, Your Honor,
OTS approval.
There are some ceilings above which they can't go, the rules, but there is no case-by-case review by OTS of the stock benefit plans. OTS has chosen now several times to rely on the shareholders as the people who know best whether this is a good idea or a bad idea. You know, and indeed, shareholders themselves have an interest in making sure management is well compensated, if they're doing a good job, that people don't leave. And so it's not as if there's a complete conflict between management and the minority shareholders, even on the stock benefit issue. But OTS says this is our safeguard. But now they deliberately set out in this proceeding to make that safeguard a formality by so atomizing ownership of the minority shares.
I think they don't deny that this diminishes the force of the safeguard. Right? I mean, you're saying it negates it altogether.
Well, yeah, it doesn't negate it altogether.
So it's a matter of degree.
Yeah, and you know, there's absolutely no explanation here about why the degree that they went to in this proceeding is the right one. I mean, and certainly the banker's comments, if you read the record, acknowledge that they thought that going down this low will effectively eliminate the leverage problem that they had perceived, but make it really impossible as a practical matter for the minority shareholders to really come and put pressure on management.
It's essentially an anti-takeover device, or analogous to an anti-takeover device in an unregulated or in an ordinary corporate context.
Right.
Right? And it impedes the market for corporate control.
It is an anti-takeover device applied to an institution where management controls 60 or 70% of the stock and can't sell it. So there isn't any real danger of takeover here. And management,
there are separate problems identified in the record, right?
There is the single problem of when using the approval of the stock benefit plans as leverage to make management do things that they would like, that the stockholders would like. And then the question is,
of course, the management then becomes stockholders, and maybe they'd like it too.
Maybe they would, Your Honor.
All the banking associations were in favor of the rule.
They certainly were, Your Honor, because it makes the manager's life a lot easier if they can put their stock benefits plans through without any effective review, and they don't have to really answer to anybody.
Wouldn't it be better than for the management to be able to say, we had to do this this merger, we had to do this repurchase, we were under pressure from an activist shareholder to maximize shareholder value, so, you know.
If they don't have their shares yet, maybe they don't get to benefit. They don't get the benefit of that.
No, but they get the shares as part of the quid pro quo with the shareholder group. Right, that they'll vote in favor of the ESOP, and the management in turn will sell the company to another firm or to a repurchase plan.
But you know, there's an enormous review process that then takes place to decide whether the management should be allowed to sell itself to another company or issue more stock or buy back stock. All of that stuff is reviewed
by OTS.
By OTS.
And do they have criteria that are known?
They have whole very detailed regulations on all of these things.
What are the criteria for approving, let's say, a stock repurchase plan?
Your Honor, I don't know the details of that. We do cite in our brief the regulation that says they have to go to OTS to get approval for the first year, and certainly that could be made longer than a year. But I don't know the specifics, Your Honor, on terms of what they look at. Presumably it has to be in the best interest of the thrift, and often it is in the best interest of the thrift.
The conflict here is the best interest of the shareholders versus this regulatory goal. So if they're looking at this and saying, no, we're not going to approve it because it's going to divert resources from the regulatory goal, then they have a device at the back end to accomplish their objective.
Correct, Your Honor.
But if there's some reason that they don't or can't do that,
I'm not aware of
it. They're doing it at the front end.
They haven't pointed to any. But what they've done at the front end, of course, as I suggested, squeezes the balloon and creates a whole other problem for which there isn't any remedy that they've suggested. And there's a good reason why the bankers thought this was a good idea. But there's no real reason as a matter of regulatory policy why you would want to leave the management free to basically establish their own stock benefit plans without meaningful review.
Well, you seem to be complaining about OTS's addressing of that separate problem, which really raises a threshold question of your standing here. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not the directly regulated party, and so for starters, that makes your standing more difficult under Lujan and in our case law.
Well, we have here petitioners who are regular investors in this particular category of institution at a level that would not be possible if the banks use the opportunity that has now been given to them to limit ownership to 10% of the minority shares. And so this is a little different from most standing and ripeness issues here because you have a regulation which authorizes Party A to do something that will harm Party B.
Doesn't require.
That's absolutely true, Your Honor. The question, though, I would submit is whether there's a substantial probability that as a result of this rule, this harm will occur. And we cited a number of cases for that proposition. Certainly,
that's certainly the test, but where do you get the substantial probability? Why don't you trace it out, how that's going to work?
Well, first of all, you have an investor who basically does this routinely every time there's an opportunity. And you have the entire banking industry urging the OTS to give them this opportunity, and it's in the interest of the management to do it. So I don't think there's any realistic chance that when the next thrift comes along to actually issue stock, they won't have taken advantage of this new opportunity given to them by OTS.
Well, they don't actually have to take advantage of it in order to disadvantage you. All they have to do is put into their issuing documents that they might take advantage of it.
That is True, although until they actually do it, of course, you can still vote your shares, but if they're above
the
level.
But all the fun of investing in the company is taken out of it if they might drop the other shoe later on.
It certainly puts you in a position, if you buy more than the prescribed amount, of having your stock sterilized, as they say, essentially become worthless in terms of voting power. And so there's clearly,
that's enough to queer your interest in investing in that company, isn't it?
Well, it certainly would if I were an investor. I don't want to buy
stocks. You are the investor here.
Excuse me?
You are the investor.
Well, I represent the investor. I was talking more personally.
I'm the same.
I think that is the gist of what we're saying here, is that we have an opportunity in a current law, until this rule came along, to buy stock up to a much higher level and vote those shares, protect our interests as shareholders of these thrifts, and now it's very, very likely that thrifts will take this opportunity given to them for the express purpose of limiting ownership to prevent us from continuing that particular business practice of buying up to that level.
Looking at your 13Ds, I think it is, with the SEC, and as you point out in your reply, most of the instances of which we're aware were investments in stock companies, not in mutuals, right? They'd either done their conversion or were going to do it to a stock company, not to a holding company.
Yeah, I believe the declaration indicates that he's had a couple dozen of the MHC investments, including five since 2005. So he certainly makes clear he'd be interested in doing this at every opportunity in the future, as long as his regulation isn't there to make it a much less desirable business practice to make those investments. So given the probability that thrifts will take this opportunity and the clear pattern of this particular group of petitioners of being involved in this particular business practice, I think under the Sabre case and a lot of other standing cases you have in this circuit, you would certainly say these people have standing. And as to ripeness, you have a finally promulgated rule that's in effect now, and OTS hasn't suggested any time in the future when something else will happen that would trigger review later on. There's a 30-day deadline here. And we complied with that deadline, and you know, they seem to be saying that the ripeness inquiry on challenging a regulation should turn on the individual circumstances of each particular possible challenger, depending, you know, their investment decisions, how those investments turn out, and that can't be the system that you establish for administrative review of regulations. There has to be a moment where some action by the government in promulgating the rule makes it a ripe rule, and we submit that standard is met
here.
Well,
that's not necessarily true. I mean, there can be rules that don't create a ripe controversy, but that later on give rise to one.
Well, there certainly are cases in which the court has found that, but those are cases where there's two other agencies that have disapproved the project that you're challenging or something like that. That's the Ongo case, where the NRC said you can do the project, but the BIA and the Interior Department said no, you can't, and the court said, well, why would we want to review that? This isn't a case like that. This rule is in effect, and it is affecting business planning right now. But more importantly, they haven't suggested something later on that will occur that will make everybody suddenly have a ripe controversy. They're sort of saying, well, each person, depending on what bank does it when, what investments they decide to make, the 30 days will start running for them at some mysterious point which we can't tell you later on. Or they seem to say that at some point what we should do is come back and file a petition for rulemaking to rescind the rule. But as the cases we cited show, all that would do is basically give us an appeal from the denial of the petition for rulemaking, which is kind of an abuse of discretion standard. It doesn't let us bring the arguments we're making here. They couldn't bring those up 2 or 3 years from now. So these arguments, if they're not considered now, I think will never be available to us to bring, and the agency shouldn't be able to evade review by making what I think are spurious ripeness arguments.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Give you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
May it please the Court. I'm Christopher Sturbins. I represent the Office of Thrift Supervision. As a very brief background, OTS is a bank regulator that regulates approximately 700 savings associations across the country, having about $1.3 trillion in assets. Of those institutions, about 300 are traditional mutual institutions that are owned completely by their depositor members, and about 120 have this hybrid structure, which is the subject of the litigation today, the mutual holding company structure. I would go immediately to the issue of injury in fact. The petitioner has no injury in fact, and there's no possibility of him having an injury in fact. The rule that the petitioner is challenging is an optional charter provision. As we set forth in our brief, only one institution in the country, Metuchen MHC in New Jersey, has adopted this optional charter provision regarding limitations on the ownership of the minority stock.
Do you know that's true as of today as well?
As of yesterday, this is still the case. No additional institution has adopted this rule. Metuchen, for example, mm-hmm. does not issue minority stock.
Okay, but let me ask this. Has any institution made a public offering of minority shares without availing itself of the possibility given to it in the new rule?
None that we know of.
Okay, well, so
no, but none have availed themselves to this possibility because they have not issued
question,
stock.
Is there anyone that has not that has done an offering without availing themselves of it?
The charter provision is the first step. They have to, the banks have to amend their charter, and then the second step would be that they would issue stock.
Right.
Only Metuchen has adopted its charter. So the answer to your question is there are none that have issued a stock offering.
I mean, that Metuchen didn't is not very probative. If a lot of, or if there were other people who went out with public offerings and didn't put this into the offering statement so they don't have the possibility of later invoking the rule, that would suggest that it's not going to harm the petitioner here.
Well, there have not been any, to my knowledge and to our knowledge as an agency, there have not been any stock offerings that have included this provision in their offerings. We're 9 months in so far, so it has not even occurred. Haven't been any offerings.
So they just don't have any indication one way or the other. But the rule is out there for anyone who wants to do, and they may be holding up their offering for this case. We don't know. But the power of this rule is that it's there, not that it's exercised. It's the power, to quote Clay Whitehead, the power of the sword of Damocles is not that it falls, but that it hangs.
I don't believe I agree with you, Your Honor, because the injury to the petitioner has to be when he is prevented from taking some ownership step beyond the 10% limit. And there's no possibility of him being unable to exercise the voting rights of greater than a 10% share because there are no institutions that are out there that either have the charter provision or have the present intention to issue the stock. The case law from the Supreme Court is very clear. We have to have an injury in fact that is immediate and not
specific. How many of these holding companies have issued stock at all? How many holding companies are there?
There are approximately 120.
Okay, and how many of them have issued stock?
Not all of them. One of the things I was trying to do yesterday was to come up with a precise number, and it's hard to massage our database. Some significant number, but not all.
Those who have already done their offering.
Correct.
Are sort of adversely grandfathered, right? They cannot take advantage of this rule?
That's one of the changes that the agency made between the initial proposal and the final rule, taking into very careful consideration the protests of some of the commenters that, hey, we've bought more than 10% at this point, and we don't want to. We relied on this the absence of this provision.
And a company that has already got a publicly traded group of shares out there do a supplemental offering that includes the rule?
If they amend their charter and they make this statement in a supplemental offering in the future, yes, they could.
So really, there isn't any protection with respect to existing institutions either for an investor.
It's only prospective from the current time.
Right, but suppose that Mr. Stilwell purchases publicly traded shares in an existing MHC, and then next year the MHC, maybe because they see Mr. Stilwell as among their shareholders, says we're going to make another offering and we're going to invoke the rule, amend our charter. He can't vote on that. He can't exercise his shares to prevent that. And we're going to invoke the rule in that supplemental offering.
If that hypothetical occurred in the future, there would be a much greater argument for Mr. Stillwell that he has sustained.
But that is possible out there. That can happen.
It's a lot of things are possible. It could be possible that I could be nominated to sit next to you on the bench by the president next week. It doesn't make it likely.
That has current consequences. You're going to behave in such a way as not to preclude that possibility if you'd like to be nominated to the bench.
I believe that it's completely speculative to say that my argument today is going to affect the president's decision to nominate me.
No, not your argument. I
believe it's completely speculative as well for Mr. Stillwell to say that there might be some bank out there that might sometime in the future that might adopt this rule that I might get. I'll give you an example of a perfect hypothetical. The largest mutual that we regulate is Dollar Bank from Pittsburgh. Dollar Bank's about a $6 billion mutual institution. If they were to do the typical MHC conversion and issue about 30% of the shares of the company to the public, they could raise in a ballpark of $2 billion in that offering. Mr. Stillwell would only be affected by this rule as if he had intended and had the ability to buy $200 million worth of shares. But his construction of standing is that because Dollar might in the future issue public stock, I'm going to be injured now.
Well, suppose can he put together a group that, you know, he gets Carl Icahn and Kirk Kerkorian and a few other well-known shareholder activists, and together they acquire the $200 million, but coordinating their activities, more than $200 million, $300 million.
This implicates the Congress's and our control regulations over savings
and
loans.
Yes, exactly.
If the group were to seek together to control more than 25% of the total stock of the institution, a group of Wall Street investors, they would be, by statute, subject to the control regulations that Congress has issued.
But that's 25% of the outstanding, which could be 49% of the minority.
Yes.
So they could do that.
They could.
That'd give them substantial leverage.
In practice, they would not want to do that because they would make themselves subject to the control regulations. They would be regulated as a savings and loan holding company. And Mr. Stillwell and other professional investors are quite scrupulously cognizant that they don't want to get above, they don't want to be regulated.
Yeah. They don't want to borrow money from the government either.
Good point, Your Honor. Let's go to the rule, because I believe that my colleague substantially overstated the effect of this rule. You look like you want to ask a question, Your Honor.
Actually, I'm advised that you've overstated one respect. The rule authorizes including the provision only in IPOs, not in a subsequent offering.
It is unusual that
initial minority stock issuance is the phrase.
Then it would only truly be prospective. My understanding is that there may be a secondary offering, but I could be incorrect on that.
If my informant is correct, then your case is stronger than you thought.
Let's go to the rule itself and its actual practical application, because I think that my colleague in his brief and in his argument substantially overstated the effect of this rule. It does not in any way, shape, or form reduce the ability of the minority shareholders as a group, as an aggregate, to vote down certain corporate changes. They're not only stock benefit plans, but also if the bank were to propose to do a full conversion, the minority shareholders have to vote to approve that. If the bank were to
presumably they would be delighted.
Well, their position might be watered down at that point. It's hard to say. The third issue that the minority of the stockholders is if you have a charitable foundation that's opened up. Typically, the most dissension and controversy has come by the management stock benefit plans, which are fairly small. They are 1.47% of the total stock of the institution.
They may be small, but there are those who love them.
In their self-interest, as well they should. It's a wise corporate tool to allow the management and employees of a company to be able to share in the success of that corporation or that bank. But what Mr. Stillwell's argument is that this rule reduces the ability of the minority shareholders to vote on these plans. That's not true at all. It reduces the ability of one single individual in this case, Mr. Stillwell complaining about his own ability. It reduces his ability to control a very large portion of the minority vote.
Right, but that creates a substantial practical problem to organizing a proxy contest.
Mr. Stillwell has shown in his 13D that he's quite capable of mounting a proper proxy campaign and does so.
But that's when he's been gotten a higher percentage to start with.
Correct.
Correct. Plus, this limits his ability to benefit from whatever is done to increase shareholder value.
And increasing shareholder value in many cases in practice means diverting money from the institution to outside interests. For example, if the bank does
outside to
the public shareholders, but not the bank. Let me give an example. If the bank has 30% of the outside of the shares are owned by the public shareholders. If the bank enacts a dividend, let's say 10 cents per share, only the public shareholders earn a dividend. The 70% of shares that are held within the bank don't get a dividend that's repaid to them. If the bank does the quite unusual step of issuing stock and then only 12 months later buying it back, the capital that the bank raised from the public stock sale is going out to the public shareholders again, reducing the capital levels of the bank.
But that also raises the share price.
It raises the share price, and I would understand why the public shareholders might want that. But the issue comes, and the reason that mutuals often engage in public share sales in the MHC context is to raise capital so that it can finance expansion, lending, and to shore up the capital base and make sure that if they sustain losses, as many banks do now, that they're able to cover those losses without implicating the taxpayer and the FDIC. That pool of capital in an MHC is a very tempting target to a sophisticated outside investor who would like nothing more in many cases to siphon it off for his own benefit, either through stock buybacks or through special dividends. And that's the danger. And that's the concern that the agency has in these kinds of circumstances. We're trying to balance the rights of the outside shareholders,
Well, if they go through, let's say they do a repurchase program, don't you have to approve that?
We do.
So you don't. So if repurchase program doesn't serve the interest that you are talking about, then you can disapprove it.
We can, and we can also, for example, forbid the bank from paying dividends if it's
right.
going
so
to threaten.
You've got all these controls at the back end. Mm-hmm. Why do you need to all of a sudden to inhibit the market for corporate control at the front end?
Well, because I think you can see from the petitioner's own filings with the court. The habit has been to use these the stock benefit plans for the management and the employees as a tool to extract money from the bank itself.
But the extraction occurs. Most of the examples were actually in pure stock companies, so it's not relevant. But for the extent it's relevant, the extraction occurs by a repurchase program or acquisition by another institution, both of which you have to approve. So if you don't think it's good for the whatever it is, a public interest, then you don't have to approve it.
Well, that's one option that the agency certainly has in its quiver of arrows. But the agency, going back on 60 years of doing this regulation, made the determination that the most expedient means of balancing these interests in this case was to reduce the ability of a single shareholder to exercise undue influence and take certain
the stated
steps.
Rationale for the rule is already solved by these other mechanisms. What's left of the rationale for the rule?
Well, that would be a different solution to the rule, and I think the reviewing courts.
In other words, the agency sees a problem out there. But the problem's already solved by these other tools that Judge Ginsburg identified, or at least the problem can already be addressed by that. So what's the use of this additional rule?
It is possible.
In other words, if those are abuses that you're referring to, they're abuses that you all approved.
Not necessarily, because the relationship between the shareholder and the board of an institution, for example, is not something that OTS is a party to. We may, in the end, understand that the institution proposes to buy back shares, but we don't know why, because the meetings that Mr. Stilwell or any other petitioner.
They've just gone out and raised capital, and shortly thereafter they proposed to buy back shares. Don't you inquire?
Well, they're barred for the first year from doing that, absolutely.
Okay, so as soon as they can, they move to have a repurchase program.
And that,
isn't that of some concern or interest?
That raises supervisory interest. It does.
Sure.
But that is only one possible way of protecting the capital position of the institution. The agency is also determined in its expertise and its long experience in this that broadening the base of the minority shareholders is another way to do this. Could there be a third way?
Does the agency lack the resources or tools to do it without this? Is that part of what's going on?
No government agency is ever going to tell you that they have enough resources, Your Honor.
True. But has that been a documented problem that justifies an additional tool to prevent the problem?
That's not something that was raised in the administrative record. It's not there.
So the agency has the tools to do this, to prevent the problem that's been identified.
It has tools to address it when it comes to its knowledge. But for example, we don't know when the Wall Street shareholders are going to meet with the board of directors of XYZ Savings and Loan. That's simply a normal corporate.
But if they meet? That doesn't harm anything.
Of course
not. Only if they propose one of these transformations that is of concern.
Correct.
And those you are aware of.
Not always by reporting, but by proposals that a thrift would make.
Right.
The larger point is that it's the role of the reviewing court not to decide what the better course of action is. It's simply to decide whether or not the decision that the agency took with this rule bears a rational basis to the problem it perceives. Perhaps there could be a third way that
duplicative agency actions are permissible.
And at this point, we come back to the standing and ripeness issue. We haven't had this problem because none of the institutions have adopted this rule, and no investor has been had his vote sterilized.
Cuts for you, actually.
Yeah.
The way that the rule will work in the future,
cuts
we don't.
For you on the standing front, but I'm not sure it helps you on the merits front.
And in the future, if it turns out that this rule is not necessary and that it has that the savings and loans the mutuals don't adopt this rule, then it may be a good idea in the future for the agency simply to abolish the rule. If no one adopts it and no one issues stock that's subject to these restrictions, which is the case now, then we certainly may revisit this as a regulatory matter in the future. But right now, we're just simply talking about possibilities of what might happen in the future if some bank might adopt these charter provisions. And right now, there's no injury, and there's no way for us to have a real firm basis to understand how the practical effects of this rule are injuring Mr. Stilwell. There simply haven't been any.
Questions?
I see that I'm out of time. I would ask the court to deny the petition for review.
Thank you, Mr. Sturbins. Mr. Smith, is there anything in Mr. Sturbins' presentation that just can't go unremarked?
Your Honor, if I might just add one fact that's not in the record, but which I ascertained yesterday, my understanding is that there haven't been any conversions to a mutual holding company structure at all since this rule took effect in October, and that there have been precious little, if any, stock offerings. As you can imagine, this is not a time when the savings bank industry is out there offering a lot of stock to the public. So the fact that there's been a kind of temporary moratorium on this doesn't mean that there won't be a revival of this to the rate of 4 or 5 or 6 a year, which Mr. Stilwell's affidavit suggests.
He said something about 5 per year, but were those IPOs? I guess they were.
Well, they are. That's when he buys the stock, as I understand it, when the stock is first offered, Your Honor. So that's the one point I wanted to make.
Aren't agencies entitled to take multiple actions to address the same problem, even if they might be overlapping, duplicative?
Well, not if the overlapping.
Prophylactic.
Not if the overlapping remedy creates another problem, which they don't have a remedy for. And Mr. Stirbens today didn't give you any indication of what the alternative remedy is going to be for management taking money and putting it in their own pockets. The key safeguard OTS has told us for that problem is effective review by minority shareholders. They then deliberately set out to make the minority shareholders unable as a practical matter to play that
role. Their argument is by using this additional tool to address the one problem, number one, it's unnecessary given the other tools, and it creates a separate problem that they haven't explained.
Which comes up every time a management exercises that power to grant themselves stock. This other problem of minority shareholder undue influence is largely a hypothetical problem. They've never pointed any time in this entire record to any bank that did something that was harmful or undesirable because they kowtowed to minority shareholders. It's just all sort of, this could happen, this would be bad, we don't like the idea of them telling us what to do. So I think that's an arbitrary and capricious set of choices. Thank you, Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Smith, Mr. Sturbins. Thank you. Case is submitted. Take a break.